5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's Monday morning, getting ready for another week of work, cleaning off my desk. Someone knocks at my door. It's the nurse practitioner. Hey, Jess, what's up? Joe passed away over the weekend. What are you talking about? Joe, our patient Joe, he passed over the weekend. I go, really? I wasn't expecting that. I didn't really know what to say. I was without words. Just left and I sat down in my office and I tried to figure out what I was feeling. It wasn't my fault that he died. He had terrible cancer. He had metastatic cancer. I knew he was going to die. I just didn't know he was going to die over the weekend. It was his fault that he died. He didn't listen to anything that anyone told him to do. He didn't really even like me. I'm not sure if I even liked him. But why do I feel so bad? Why do I feel terrible? Why do I feel like I failed him? Today's episode, Confessions, is going to be about how we deal with difficult patients. Angel Santana, welcome to another Wednesday.
Welcome, 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 my friend. I don't even want to talk. Let's just go right into it. That was an awesome intro.
Every physician, every nurse, every caregiver has to deal with a group of patients that we term difficult. To be a difficult patient means many different things. There's many different sizes, shapes, identifications. Joe was difficult because he never listened to any medical advice and he did whatever he wanted to do. Sometimes we get patients that are angry. Sometimes they're angry at their disease. Sometimes they're angry at their caregivers. Sometimes they're just angry at life. We have manipulative patients that are deemed difficult because they're never honest and they always have a hidden agenda, whether it be to get disability. We have our drug-seeking patients that are looking to take their medications and sell them. We have our corrupt patients that are trying to get around the system. And of course, as I said about Joe, the non-compliant patients, which are probably the most frustrating. So what do we do when we're surrounded or confronted with a difficult patient? I'd like to think that we all do our best to serve their needs despite our personal feelings. But why do we have those feelings? Why are those feelings so negative? Why do we get so insulted when a patient doesn't take our advice? Why don't we dig a little deeper? Why can't we do a little better? And that's what we're going to talk about today. When a physician gets in a conflict with a patient, negative emotions develop and dominate. These negative emotions are initiated by an action of the patient and then metabolized incorrectly by the caregiver. And this creates a very conflictual negative dyad. And unfortunately, once that dyad, once that commitment to that interface between yourself and your patient presents itself, you've already lost the game because you've already lost the ability to connect with them on a level that can help them. Now, you will perform excellent medicine. You will take very good care of this patient. You will do the best you can with what they allow you to do for them. However, you don't do the best you can do. There is a way that you can manage these difficult patients much differently, and that's what we're going to explore. When I was thinking about Joseph and his passing, and when I was trying to figure out what it was that I was feeling, I went to the computer and I did a literature search about difficult patients. And there's no surprise. There's a voluminous amount of material and articles as it relates to the difficult patient. But one stood out to me, one spoke to me. It's from a Dr. Jody Halpern, and it was published many years ago, 13, 14 years ago, in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. And basically, this was the model that I wanted to discuss today. In order to try to connect with a difficult patient, there is one road to take, and that road ends at a bridge, and I call it the bridge of empathy. It is the caregiver's responsibility to create that bridge and to develop that empathy to better connect with this difficult patient. And if you don't do this, if you don't build this empathy, what will happen is the conflict will create a barrier to the best outcome that you can achieve for your patient. So there is a definition for empathy if you go to Merriam-Webster, but there are two different definitions for empathy as it relates to the general public as opposed to the medical community. So if you wanted to be an empathetic person, or if you were a Star Trek person and watched a lot of Star Trek, you would remember that one of the crew members was an empath, meaning that they were able to feel the emotions and feelings of another. The outside definition, the lay definition of empathy is a complex, effective, cognitive situation. So let's define those two words. What's effective and what's cognizant? So effective relates to feelings and emotions. Cognitive relates to knowledge. So in order to develop true empathy, you have to have a marriage between the mind and the heart and the soul. It involves an emotional attunement that you need to key into for the person. And you have to be able to imagine how another person feels. We consider this, we hear the cliche, take a walk in someone else's shoes. That's empathy. If you could not only be able to see a person's thought process, understand their thought process rationally, then look out to find out what they're feeling, what their true feelings and emotions are, and marry those two different parts of the brain, it's then and only then that you can establish an empathetic position as it relates to another human being. In medicine, it's a bit different. Empathy in the medical community is defined as purely cognitive, meaning only of the mind. And I put in parentheses in my notes, robotic. It's an understanding of a patient's emotions, but only understanding their emotions intellectually, not with your heart. And it allows the physician, the caregiver, to develop a special professional detached concern for their patient. Now, Angel, what do you think that Tom here, your cancer survivorship bus driver and the Croc founder and the Croc advocate, what does he feel about the word detachment when it comes to your doctor?
It just doesn't, to me, when I hear detachment with your name, it doesn't work.
Detachment is a four-letter word to the Croc Nation. As a matter of fact, we are one of the major pillars of the Croc Nation initiative is to try to eradicate and burn down the walls of detachment. So all I had to do was read that word, and I was in this article. I was up to my neck in this article. To be fair, and I always try to be fair, I always try to look at the other side. Maybe I'm learning to be an empathetic person. Detachment has been viewed necessary for objectivity, avoiding burnout, avoiding negative emotions during a conflict with a patient. But detachment is the enemy of the Croc Nation. Instead, what I would like to work on today is to try to develop an algorithm, a goal, a challenge. Our aim is to change this model, become emotionally attuned to our patients, and develop that complex, effective, cognitive, empathetic position. And if we do that, Believe it or not, there is scientific evidence that suggests that increasing this emotion, engaging physicians emotionally with their patients, have a greater therapeutic efficacy. That means, in plain English, patients do better when they feel that their caregivers truly care about them as human beings, truly care about them, not just intellectually care about them, not only take the responsibility of caring for their medical needs, but get to know who they are as people, attune to them as people, and develop this true sense of knowing what they're going through, taking a walk in their shoes. This empathetic distillation, this empathetic situation, then causes engagement, which then engages trust, which then engenders better patient adherence to the treatment plan, better communication, less anxiety, better coping skills, and as I said, better outcomes. Patients will disclose 100 times more intimate and detailed information to a caregiver that has an empathetic position toward them, that are caring toward them. But this is a battle that we need to continue to fight, because this fight is not over. This podcast is a voice in the wilderness. There are still the majority of models in the patient, physician, or caregiver model where detachment is the norm. And we need to reverse that. It's a challenge. And by definition, conflict is a soil where no grass can grow, where no empathy can be generated. So it's a vicious cycle of a patient behaving in a difficult manner, dragging the caregiver into this vicious cycle of conflict, of negative emotions, negative feelings, and bad outcomes. And we can do better. We can do better. So do we just give up, Angel? Should I just give up? Should I raise the white flag and give into this reality? Or should we create a new reality, a better reality?
No, we never give up.
So if that's the truth, and if that is the truth, by the way, because you know one thing in this podcast for you Croc Nation people, we will never give up for you. Angel and I will fight until there is no breath in our lungs to make sure we get to whoever we have to get to make your lives better, to make your interface with your caregivers better, to make the anxiety less, to help you cope, to give you the skills you need. So before we start building this bridge, we need to discuss two key emotions. So in order for us to develop, and again, we're going to take baby steps, we know that physicians are very good at cognitive, intellectual perception of the situation. It's what we're trained to do. And sometimes, on occasion, even with a difficult patient, we'll develop a very, this is a very simple word, it's a word that we hear all the time, we develop sympathy to a patient. But sympathy is missing one key ingredient. If you were to make a batch of cancer survivorship chocolate chip cookies, you would need a little bit of sympathy, you would need a little bit of cognitive, you would need a little bit of affective, and you would need a little bit of curiosity. It's this last part, this crucial ingredient, this being curious about a patient that really tunes us in. So it's not just caring about them intellectually. It's not just trying to understand their emotions and their feelings, but it's also to develop a bit of sympathy, sort of melted with or joined with curiosity, which then completely tunes us in and allows us to bring down the trusses that we need to put in place to build that bridge of empathy in order to connect with that difficult patient. So there are five steps, according to Dr. Halpern's model, to building this bridge of empathy. The first is to recognize one's emotions in real time. So there's something going on when somebody gets under your skin, we use the term angel, pushing our buttons. And we as physicians, unlike nurses or therapists, we are not at all positioned or trained to learn to attune to our negative feelings. We shut them down. They begin the process of detachment in medical school. When we begin our first day of medical school, they introduce you to your cadaver, and we basically take the cadaver, which was once a living, breathing rainbow of a human being who was loved and who loved, and we basically look at the hand and the arm and the thoracic cavity and the brain and the abdominal cavity and the muscles and the bones, and it is all basically compartmentalized. And we don't see that cadaver as a person. It starts from day one. Then in our training, at least in my day, it's much different now, thankfully, where these poor youngins don't have the same pressures we did. But we would literally be in the hospital for 3 or 4 days at a time without sleep and under very high stress situations. So the thought of connecting with our own feelings was not even, it wasn't even on the menu. I mean, there was no menu, take care of yourself. It was like, you take care of your patients. Even if you were going to die, you make sure you take care of your patients first. Don't worry about yourself. And in order to explore feelings, like, that was a no-no. Never were we ever encouraged to think about our feelings or to discuss our feelings or to even feel. You know, speaking of robotic, we were just robotic healers is really what we were. And because we were never in tune with these feelings, how to address these negative feelings, I think that we became socialized and trained against self-reflection. And believe it or not, self-reflection is a skill which can be taught, which can be learned, which can be integrated into us, which will add a entire new facet to us as healers. It will make us better. It will make us be able to connect, not just with the people who like us. A patient comes in, they bring us cookies. They're so thankful. They're grateful that they got in to see us. They're so, happy. I mean, how could you not like that person? So that's no challenge. You want to be able to, and again, this is a non-denominational podcast, but you got to learn how to turn the other cheek. I mean, it's really easy to be nice to people that are nice to you. What you have to learn is how to be extra nice and extra effective in the people who don't like you, or the people that are angry at you, or the people that you're in conflict with you. And again, that first step, it's a self-awareness which could reduce errors, improve decision-making, and resolve conflict. Step number two, reflecting on negative emotions over time. So this is really cool because I don't know if you know this, Angel, I was this close to becoming a psychiatrist.
And for the viewers that can't see, you literally have
millimeters away from millimeters.
Really?
So when I was trying to make a decision on what to do when I grew up, I had always thought I was going to be a psychiatrist for a number of reasons. Maybe we'll do a podcast on this, but it didn't happen. I became a radiation oncologist.
Well, you tend to be mine.
There you go. Exactly. So there is two really important phenomena in psychotherapy, which are Freudian, which go back to Sigmund Freud. And these are exercises, or these are skills that we can train ourselves to get good at. And it's really the force that drives therapy to success. And it's transference and countertransference. So a transference is when a patient who's in psychotherapy might have had a terrible relationship with their parents, a very unsafe relationship with their parents, and the therapist becomes a surrogate as a parent. So the person, and what a good therapist will do is they'll utilize that transference to their advantage to help the patient. So they'll accept the role of being the parent or providing a safe environment for their patient until they can break them down and build them back up where they no longer need to transfer the parent model onto the therapist. Mm. But there's another thing that happens in therapy, and you wouldn't even think about it. But there's also a thing called countertransference. And for the purposes of today's podcast about how to deal with a difficult patient, how to muster up some empathy, it's the countertransference which is most critical, because Joseph hit a nerve in me. There was something about Joseph that I took very seriously. It went through my intellect, into my soul, into my core. And there was something that I saw in him which had nothing to do with Joseph, because I had just met him a year ago. He refused everything. But why should that have made me so angry? Why should that have pushed me away? Why should that have threatened me? And we're going to talk about that at the end when we evaluate how I could have been better, what I could have done better for Joseph. So we learned about transference, counter transference. And while we're going through step two, this is the time when we need to deal and try to find out a little bit about that patient. We need to find out a little bit about who they are and get a little curious about who they are, what makes them tick, and a curiosity as far as why we are behaving or feeling or experiencing the feelings that we're feeling, you know, from the doctor who's not supposed to feel, right? So we need to change that. We also have to utilize and recognize this transference and countertransference. That's key to part two, to step two. Part three is attuning to the emotional message in the patient's story. So this guy, Joe, and I'll use a couple of examples, was a very successful man. He was a retired stockbroker. He was a successful writer. And he had his entire life really been very successful. He was successful in his relationships. He was successful in his profession. He was successful in everything except his metastatic prostate cancer. Had I been able to break through and get to who Joe was before he was sick, that would have made a big difference. I would have been able to begin attuning to Joe. I could have been able to begin to get to know what he's about and why he was behaving the way he did. He was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer from the minute he was, you know, it wasn't like he went from prostate cancer to metastatic disease. And just for those people on the podcast who don't know what that means, meaning cancer that has spread already to other parts of the body. Wow. He presents day one with prostate cancer that has spread to the bone, to the lymph nodes, to the liver, to the lung. Joe is a really, really, really sick guy. Wow. It took a few weeks for the doctor, the medical oncologist, to talk him into doing some chemotherapy, wanted a second opinion, went to Memorial, blah, 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 started his chemotherapy. And Joe had an amazing response to his therapy. And for 1 year, his disease began to melt away. And that's when I met him. I met him a year into his treatment when it was time to get his radiation. And he didn't want radiation. And I talked to him 6 ways till Sunday, and he wouldn't do it. He wanted a second opinion. He wanted an experimental treatment, which was not without foundation. And he wanted everything but to get what he needed to stay where he was. And because he did not do that, his cancer exploded and became unmanageable. And by the time he came back to me, it was already too late. But could we have done anything to have changed that? The other thing we have to talk about is as an example to attuning to an emotional message, is there's an example in Halpern's paper about an 18-year-old athlete, handsome young man with irritable bowel syndrome or some sort of irritable bowel disease that needed to have some of his bowel removed and have a colostomy. And he had all of these strong, healthy male doctors go into his room and say, you got to get the surgery or you're going to die. And the young man said, no, I'd rather die, actually, because I don't want to have a colostomy. I want to be a very active guy. So someone was smart enough, somebody had read this paper, or someone was emotionally mature enough to realize that there was something else going on here. And they got a nurse who had colon cancer, who had a colostomy, to go in and sit down and talk with him. And what the nurse found out was his reluctance to have the surgery, to have this colostomy, had nothing to do with anything except he wanted to be a normal 18-year-old. He wanted to go out with girls. He wanted to have an active sex life. He wanted to play ball. He wanted to do everything. But when this woman, who was vulnerable, who was empathetic, who had actually walked in her in his shoes, sat down and actually spent the time to get to know what was really bothering him, only then did he really break down and agree to have the surgery, which ended up saving his life. So that's very crucial, very crucial. And this is a nice segue into step number four, attending to the nonverbal communication. Every time you sit down with a patient, they can tell you something without them even opening up their mouth. You look at their nonverbal hints. You look at their body language. You look at their pauses, their gestures, their vocal tones, their interpersonal distance. And then you look at yourself. Now, you know, we're against the stiff white coat because it creates that distance, that detachment. And we have to learn how to adapt and adjust to what they're throwing out at us and not what they're throwing at us verbally, because sometimes it's easier to be yelled at than try to figure out somebody who's just being hostile in a quiet way. Mm. Sometimes you just want to be yelled at. When we were young, our parents, if they were mad at us, we would rather get the belt than have them ignore us, you know? So, you know, and again, we're talking about child, child punishment, you know, back in the 1960s, which parents would probably go to jail now. But, you know, again, there's a big difference. So it's the nonverbal cues, right? The last is the hardest. And the last step is accepting negative feedback. Now, think about that for a second. You're a doctor, you're a nurse, you know, you're basically taught, you know, how to save lives. You're taught the art of something that it goes back to the beginning of history, probably the most noble of all the professional arts, to have the ability to heal, to have the ability to take care and quell illness and stop pain. And you think you're pretty damn hot, right? And then somebody tells you suck. You know, that is not cool. You have to have a lot of maturity to deal with that. And in addition, you have to sort of deal with this. You have to find out why you're getting yelled at. Luckily, at least in my case, and again, our confessions module, there will be many, many confessions we will go through. And again, the purpose of having a confessions module is to recognize an error and try to remedy that error and utilize my errors to help other practitioners grow as well. But during conflict, we're taught to stand up and take charge and be strong and be forceful. But that's the last thing we need to be. We need to be quiet. We need to be still. We have to listen. Instead of being defensive and a baby and scared that, you know, we're being shamed or someone's trying to put us down, and rather being that controlling caregiver, that's the time that we need to take our shame and take our guilt and evaluate our countertransference and figure out what's going on. And if it's appropriate, apologize. Mm. Apologize because quite frankly, whether we said all the right things in all the right ways and all went down our checklist, right? Our consent checklist, our questions checklist, second opinion checklist, give them our cell phone numbers. Remember our last confessions module. I did all of those things. It didn't penetrate, but that's still my fault because I didn't figure out a way of being able to communicate effectively with that person. So even when we're right, we're wrong. And that's going to be a hard pill to swallow. get the analogy, but that's the truth. Some of the ways that we can do this is we can do it through journaling, through writing, through meditation, to learn to be quiet, to learn to be still. Talking with your colleagues, you know, hey, Bob, how do you deal with a difficult patient? You've been in practice 40 years, 5 years more than me. Like, how do you deal when somebody yells at you? How do you deal with this? And then they have seminars. They have role-playing seminars. Oh. They do, where physicians could learn how to sort of prepare themselves for these very uncomfortable situations. Actually, we just mentioned uncomfortable discussions as also on your podcast, today's podcast from Have Faith, Let It Begin.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now let's go back to Joe. So Joe, real life example. I'm not, obviously his name isn't Joe, and I'll never tell you his name, but regardless, what could I have done better? What could I have done differently? Well, number one, I should not have had him make me feel that he was doubting my skills. When he didn't do what I wanted him to do, I should have not disengaged. I should have got in more engaged. Number two is that I should have evaluated what were the buttons he was pushing. And it became very apparent for those of you who don't know my personal story. My father died when he was very young, and he died, I don't want to say by his own hand, in the sense that he did not purposefully commit suicide, but his lifestyle and his addictions caused him to die at the age of 40, 48, actually, to be more accurate. And I never really felt comfortable or really got those feelings out of me that had he only listened to his doctors, had he only done something a little different, then he, instead of leaving his 12-year-old son, he would have been there when I needed him, and he wasn't. And that was that caused a lot of inner anger for years and years and years and years. Instead of being empathetic toward his addiction, there was more anger, you know, at the abandonment. And my friend Joseph, I wish I was his friend. I regret not being his friend. Push that button, push the father button, push that. My father didn't do anything his doctors told him. And had he listened, had Joseph listened to us, I can't tell you he would have lived a longer life, because he was already, he was my age. He was in his, you know, I'm 61. He was around 57 or so. But he definitely would have done better for longer and had a longer life. And had I been able to be more engaged when he asked for these second opinions, even though I knew they would be worthless, or been more engaged trying to help him find out about the clinical trials, had I been able to be, instead of me licking my wounds and worrying about myself, I should have been trying to figure out a way through these five steps to connect with Joseph, to have been a better caregiver to him. And I want the Croc Nation to know, if you are a difficult patient, or if you are thought of as being a difficult patient, because you may not even know you're difficult. I doubt Joseph knew he was difficult, which is fine. That's not your responsibility. It's our responsibility to deal with whatever is put in front of us. It's very possible that what I'm going to teach you all today, now again, the Croc podcast is for cancer survivors, but it's also here for families of cancer survivors, and also here for our caregivers. So if there happens to be a physician out there, or a patient who's termed difficult and they don't understand why, or why they're getting negative feelings from their nursing staff, from their doctors, why they're feeling this hostility, why people are ignoring them, because they're not listening, because they want a more non-traditional approach to their cancer, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's our responsibility as your caregivers to be able to elevate ourselves, to take the step up, to take the time to build this bridge of empathy. Because when that bridge is built, the foundation for that bridge, the connection with our patients, will be so strong that we will be able to mitigate the difficulties and help even better serve our patients. And it's not just about great medicine, because anybody could practice great medicine. It's about something far more important than that. Angel, your thoughts.
You know, I have to, something stuck in the whole show, a great, great show, by the way. I have to ask, and this could probably be its own podcast module. You talked about robotic. So I want to go back. It's almost in the beginning. You talked about how when you were trained, did the Dr. E in you, the inner E, not the one that was being trained to be robotic, felt that there's something wrong here? Why wouldn't I be allowed to have that relationship with your patient? Did you already know off the bat that that's something you didn't feel comfortable with?
I think that's a great question. I think that I never bought into that whole robotic situation. I mean, I've always been a rebel when it comes to that. And I've never believed in any sort of a detached interaction with a patient. So in that regard, I was very unconventional. But I really, because of my background, and now the Croc Nation knows a little bit about, you know, my childhood, it always has fostered a bit of insecurity in me. So when I have been in difficult situations and uncomfortable situations and conflictual situations with patients, many times my immaturity or my countertransference would sort of work against me to try to build that bridge of empathy. So on the surface, absolutely unconventional, didn't believe in the detached model ever from day one, even from medical school, because I became very close with our cadaver. You know, I used to bless that cadaver every time we would start the dissection. I would thank that cadaver for teaching us. I was very weird in those days because people would be, you know, putting cigarettes in the cadaver's mouths and do very disrespectful things. And here I was looking at this cadaver as a holy spiritual being. You know, here, you know, these people donated their bodies to science. And it was like such an honor to be able to be there. So I always felt a little detached and different than my classmates. But at the same time, you know, that immaturity in me, that sort of being, you know, if someone would call me out and tell me that, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, or you know, you should send me somewhere else or whatever, I took that very personally. And it was very, very, and it took years and years and decades, you know, to get to the point where I could have a patient like Joseph be able to teach me this lesson. And I will say that these circumstances, thankfully, in my life, in my professional life, are very few and far between. But when they happen, they're very explosive, and I'm very sensitized to it because I know I could do a better job. And, you know, was the proper medicine given to this gentleman? Absolutely. Did I do the best medical job I could have done for him? Absolutely. Did I do anything wrong on him? Absolutely not. But I still believe that had I tried to connect with him on this deeper level with an empathetic connection, perhaps the outcome would have been different or better.
And that's all I really have. I think that was a great episode. I think that right there should be a consideration for another module. We'll talk about that offline, but that, I mean, because there's so much.
Angel, you're not only my co-host, you're my producer. I do whatever you tell me.
Oh,
Angel, this was a short and sweet one today on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon in the Hudson Valley. I know what you're thinking. Where is he going now? Well, it's going to be really simple. We're going to close out. We close out with our gratitude shout outs. Angel Santana, Have Faith, Let It Begin. Please listen to his podcast. Get yourself spiritually renewed. I'd like to thank Rod Freeman, who's somewhere on the roads of the United States.
San Francisco right
He's
now.
He's in San Francisco having the greatest time with his kids and his wife, and hopefully not his mother-in-law. No, I'm only kidding. I never met his mother-in-law. I'm sure she's wonderful. But for any small business owner who wants to get out there, grow their product, let people know that they're there, need some social media attention. Old dinosaurs like me who never heard of Twitter, have never heard of Facebook, will need my friend Rod Freeman. Rod Freeman, small biz up, look him up. Michael John Benzea and Charlotte Larson are amazing patrons. for their belief in us, for their belief in what we're doing. And of course, to our Croc Nation, on behalf of Angel Santana and myself, we end this podcast as we end every podcast, wishing you all a long, healthy, happy, cancer-free life. Peace. God bless you. God keep you.